When I was a teacher of middle school students teaching primarily history, I had the privilege of leading 7th and 8th graders every other year to the Washington, D.C. area for a week-long trip to see some of where history had happened and some of the monuments and memorials that have been built in order to commemorate a lot of that history. And by far, in the city of Washington itself, my favorite place to take students, my favorite place to go myself, is the Lincoln Memorial. Every time I go to the Lincoln Memorial, I cannot help but be moved. It is an imposing structure just physically. The building itself is one of the more impressive monuments in a city of impressive monuments. But one of the things that has always struck me about the Lincoln Memorial is that it calls attention to what I think is Lincoln's greatest legacy as a president, and it is to the fact that his words carried a nation forward through difficult times. The memorial consists, of course, of the famous statue of Lincoln seated in the center of the monument, but to each side, two of Lincoln's greatest speeches, which I would argue are two of the greatest speeches given in American history, are contained in their entirety on the walls. The Gettysburg Address to one side, which you see, it's the one in one column, and Lincoln's second inaugural address, given in three columns on the opposite side. Lincoln was known for being a person who could use words effectively and persuasively. The Gettysburg Address is easily the best example of that, 271 words long. He gave that speech on the occasion of the dedication of the cemetery at Gettysburg, where the bodies of the tens of thousands of casualties on the Union side were to be laid to rest. He was the second speaker that day. He almost wasn't invited to the occasion. A man named Edward Everett, who was known as the leading public speaker in the country at the time, was the primary speaker, and he spoke for a little over 2 hours. His speech clocks in at 13,601 words. And after he had finished speaking, Lincoln got up to deliver his 271 words. And Lincoln, in the midst of the Gettysburg Address, if you, like I, memorized it at some point in your life, as used to be the case in school, you used to have to memorize the Gettysburg Address at some point in your education, you know that he drops this little line, that history will not long remember what we say here. And there's an irony that 160 years later, not only do we remember what he said, but many people have actually memorized what he said. But it's true of Edward Everett that no one remembers what he said. And in a letter to Lincoln following the occasion, Everett said, "I would flatter myself to think that I got as close in 2 hours to describing the significance of that event as you did in 2 minutes. Lincoln had a way with words, and words matter, and words are powerful. And Lincoln was known for his brevity. He could say a lot in a few short words. He said this that actually echoes one of the Proverbs, and everyone agrees that much of Lincoln's way with words is based on his familiarity with Scripture. "Nearly all men can stand adversity," he said, "but if you want to test a man's character, give him power." Whenever I hear anyone arguing for slavery, I feel a strong impulse to see it tried on them personally. No matter how much cats fight, there always seem to be plenty of kittens. The hen is the wisest of all the animal creation because she never cackles until the egg is laid. Lincoln, like wisdom literature in the ancient world, draws on the physical world for much of its wisdom. Lincoln came of age at the time that photography was invented, and he said this, "There are no bad pictures. That's just how your face looks sometimes." Appropriate from our president, who never was in the running for any of our best-looking president contests. And he knew that and said, "If I were two-faced, would I be wearing this one?" Words matter. Words impact us. Words are weighty and significant. And Proverbs is a book of words. And 1/4 of the book is about words. It's words about words. Which may seem redundant and tedious and tiresome, But words matter. Lincoln knew it, and all of us know it at some level. And so this morning, we're going to explore what Proverbs has to say about the things we say. And so the first thing that Proverbs has to say about the things we say is that we shouldn't say anything until we've heard and listened well. Wise words are heard before they are spoken. We have titled this series, The Invitation, and the book opens with this invitation, and the invitation is repeated numerous times throughout the book to listen. To listen to the words of the wise. And so we're going to begin there this morning. Proverbs 22, 17 through 21, introducing a collection of sayings, says this, "Incline your ear, lean in, listen closely, in other words, and hear the words of the wise, and apply your heart to my knowledge. For it will be pleasant if you keep them within you, these words, if all of them are ready on your lips, that your trust may be in Yahweh. I have made them known to you today, even to you. Have I not written for you 30 sayings of counsel and knowledge to make you know what is right and true, that you may give a true answer to those who sent you?" These verses lay out the plan of the sage, of the wise person. It is to pass on something that has been received. It's something that is to be studied. Apply yourself to knowledge. It's not simply to be received by rote memorization and then regurgitated. It's to be taken deep within so that these words reside in our hearts and may inform the way in which we speak. And as such, the Proverbs are written to be memorable, but not simply so they can be regurgitated by rote memorization. They're to take up residence deep within us so that we then can be people who speak wisely. Proverbs 18:2 says this, "A fool takes no pleasure in understanding, but only in expressing their opinion." We receive the words of the wise. We receive that which God has made known. And so we are first people who listen, so that when we speak, we are not simply expressing our own opinion, but we have first come to an understanding. This verse probably needs to be put on bumper stickers in our society today. How quickly we rush to express our opinions. How quickly we respond to the things that are said around us, rather than taking time to come to an understanding of what is being said, what is being discussed, the issue that is being raised. And with rapidity, we make our opinion known. It's the air we breathe. It's the culture we live in. It's the way our society is operating. Rapid-fire opinions and everyone loving to express their own. And Proverbs says that is the way of the fool. The wise person pauses. Just wait a hot second before you hit send on that tweet. Come to an understanding. Proverbs 29:11 puts it this way, "A fool gives full vent to their spirit, but a wise person quietly holds it back." The wise person is one who exercises restraint with their words, not saying everything that's on their mind and heart. We live, again, in a time where everyone airs everything out, just being real. And there is virtue in honesty and authenticity, do not misunderstand. But all the time, always giving full vent to everything on our minds, to the whole world, is not wisdom. And there are consequences for this. One of those uncomfortable themes in Proverbs is that the words of the foolish bring negative consequences, and it's phrased in terms that are just, they land on us abruptly in our day and age. There's this emphasis on corporal punishment, rods and beatings, and it's put out there, and we've talked about this, that Proverbs isn't always affirming as good the things that it remarks on, the things that it describes. But in the world of the ancient mind, physical beating was an appropriate corrective both for grown-ups and for children, with heavy, blunt objects. It's something we don't think about as appropriate, but Proverbs talks about it, and we need to take to heart that foolish speech carries consequences in God's universe. Proverbs 14:3, by the mouth of a fool comes a rod for their back, but the lips of the wise will preserve them. Whether it's physical punishment or not, we have all experienced a time where our mouth got out ahead of us and we suffered for it. And we wish that we could put those words back and nobody ever heard them, right? But we know that that's not the case, and relationships suffer. Consequences come because of foolish speech. Wise people restrain themselves and seek to avoid those negative consequences. Proverbs puts this in harsh physical terms, the consequences that come, and it's the last degree by which God seeks to correct us. And so the attribute of the wise is a willingness to listen to reproof. Proverbs 25:12. Like a gold ring or an ornament of gold is a wise reprover to a listening ear. There's a grace and a beauty that adorns a wise person when they listen to reproof. And this is that sort of counterintuitive thing. We think, well, if someone is wise, they hardly need correcting. The wise person is one who knows they need correcting and receives it gladly, such that it adorns them. It becomes something that is adding beauty and grace to their person. And we know that when someone is willing to be corrected, willing to be reproved, we think better of them, even though they needed correction and reproof. Stubborn people get very little acclaim for being stubborn. Proverbs 16:23 says this, "The heart of the wise makes their speech judicious and adds persuasiveness to their lips." So this is not about silence being wise and speech being foolish, not at all. The wise person makes their speech judicious. They choose their words carefully. They choose their occasion carefully. They choose their audience carefully. And in doing so, their speech is persuasive. They understand people as well as the thing they're trying to say so that they can achieve the persuasion they're seeking to. They gain a hearing. They'll be listened to when they speak. And this helps us untangle one of those puzzles that I raised the first week we delved into the book of Proverbs from Proverbs 26:4-5, where we see this seeming contradiction. We're instructed not to answer fools according to their folly, lest we be like them. And then we're to answer fools according to their folly, lest they be wise in their own eyes. This is not a contradiction, although it seems like one. This is a question of occasion and audience and purpose. Are we engaging with the fool in a foolish way? They're giving full vent to their spirit, and so we answer back, giving full vent to ours. They're expressing their opinion unreservedly without understanding, and so we just fire back. Don't do that. But it doesn't mean not to answer or engage the fool in their folly. It's to do it in a way that brings about wisdom, judiciously, with persuasion, understanding them, listening first, even to the fool, to understand what's driving it so that we can give wise answers and hopefully bring them to a place of wisdom. So words are significant, but they start with listening, with pausing, with understanding our heart, understanding God's heart, understanding the heart of the person we're speaking to or preparing to speak to. And the reason for all of that is that words don't originate on the lips. Words flow from the heart. The wise person understands this. Wise words flow from the heart. It should be said as well, foolish words flow from the heart as well. Words come from within. They don't spring from the lips, they come from deep within. So Proverbs 18:4 describes it this way, "The words of a person's heart are deep waters. The fountain of wisdom is a bubbling brook." this image, again, drawn from nature, of a brook that bubbles up, and the heart is this wellspring, and it bubbles up and flows from the mouth. Proverbs, almost as often as it talks about the lips and the tongue and the mouth when it speaks of speech, speaks of the heart as though interchangeable, because it understands that speech is not just a matter of diction and grammar and vocabulary. It's an expression of what's going on in a person's heart. One of the more mysterious proverbs that I looked at this week is Proverbs 16:1, and this should both sober us and cause us to scratch our heads. I almost didn't include it because it's a tricky one to make sense of. The plans of the heart belong to man, but the answer of the tongue is from Yahweh. Now think about that for a minute. This is, again, one of those things where I feel like it. If I were writing it, which of course I'm not, I would reverse it and say, the things that are going on in the heart are where God operates, but then I speak and mess the whole thing up. That would be how I would write this proverb. God's doing something in my heart, and I'm supposed to say something in accord with that, and I'm likely to misrepresent what it is that God is trying to do. But this flips it and says, you're trying to, in your heart, discern what is an appropriate answer. What are the appropriate words for the occasion and the person to whom you're speaking? And then there's this assurance. You're trying to sort that out in your heart. Trust that God will guide your lips to give the appropriate answer. This is by no means a guarantee that every time a human being opens their mouth, it's the word of God. We all know that that cannot be further from the truth. But it's an assertion to say, if words flow from the heart, then the heart that is wrestling and planning and striving to follow after God's ways, God will guide the words from their lips. And how often has that been true for us? I have been on the receiving end of this on any number of occasions where someone has felt prompted in their heart with something to say. And without knowing the circumstances I'm considering or facing or dealing with, they say something and I say, that is absolutely something God wanted me to hear. That is absolutely something God wanted me to hear. Thank you for following that prompting. And they'll often say, I wasn't sure if I should say it or if it would mean anything, but I followed that prompting. Wise words flow from the heart, and when the heart of the person is being formed by the Spirit of the all-wise God, the words of the tongue carry immense power. One of the chief attributes of wise words that Proverbs addresses is that they are honest. Wise words bring truth and justice. Over and over and over and over again, almost to the point of tediousness, and almost from a standpoint of saying, does that really need to be said even one time? Shouldn't it be a given that wise words are true? That honesty is, of course, the way that God would have us speak. And I think there's something that tells me that it is not obvious, that it is not the way we tend to operate. Think about how easy it is in any given situation when you are about to open your mouth to be tempted to fudge or to hedge on the absolute truth. Whether in little things or big things, that pressure is constant. And this is not about giving full vent to our spirit, just expressing our opinions. But we are often pressured by a myriad of things around us not to be fully truthful and honest. And we get comfortable living in patterns where some level of deception is a given. That is the way the world around us operates, and all too often, speaking only for myself, it is how we operate. And Proverbs has a great deal to say about this because there is something about false speech that is the primary way that our speech can be foolish and harmful. Proverbs 24 gives us a description of the sorts of false speech we run into in the world. Proverbs 24:23, these also are sayings of the wise. Partiality in judging is not good. Favoritism, we alluded to this a little bit last week. But it comes in the form of speech. And there's quite a bit of overlap, incidentally, between what Proverbs says about speech and what Proverbs says about justice, which is interesting. Many of the verses that deal with justice are also dealing with the way we speak, and this is one of them. Whoever says to the wicked, "You are in the right," calling crime virtue, will be cursed by peoples, abhorred by nations. But those who rebuke the wicked will have delight, and a good blessing will come upon them. Whoever gives an honest answer kisses the lips. This is a legal setting. This is a judicial setting. And Proverbs makes it clear that honesty in the public square is of paramount importance. And I would simply submit that our public square at this moment in time is clouded from all quarters by anything but honesty and truthfulness. We are plagued by a culture, a public square, that is framed by partiality, saying whatever needs to be said to justify our particular group. In the days of Solomon and the writings of the Proverbs, it was a matter of rich and poor. In our society, take your pick. There are so many identifications that we can make, but our speech is often customized to justify our own group at the expense, all too often, of truth. Proverbs 19:28 makes this explicit, saying that a worthless witness scoffs at justice, and the mouth of the wicked devours iniquity. Another bit of a mysterious proverb that sounds a little backwards in some ways. I want to call attention, first of all, to this scoffing. Scoffing is something that's mentioned repeatedly throughout the book of Proverbs. It's one of those groups that's equated with the fool. And it's one of the groups that's seen as the hardest to reach. So not every term that's translated fool in the book of Proverbs is the same word in Hebrew. There's degrees of foolishness, if you will. And some fools are just simpletons. They're just uninformed. And so they might be receptive to instruction, and they just need to be guided. But then you have these groups like the scoffers. These are the people for whom nothing is to be taken seriously. Nothing is sacred. They're cynical. And they're not willing to invest authentically in anything. And so it says here, they make a mockery of justice. They're so cynical about the process that society engages in to determine righteousness and justice that they don't engage in it honestly. They don't think there's anything serious going on. There's just their own self-interest. And then the second part, that the mouth of the wicked devours iniquity. What that means is that their diet, what they ingest, is iniquity, injustice, favoritism, self-interest. And that's what comes back out. What you ingest is what comes back out. And that's what's being said here. It's a rather graphic description when you come right down to it. But what's being said is because their diet is injustice, their witness, their bearing witness about the world around them scoffs at justice. And as we saw last week, justice is something that is incredibly close to the heart of the God who made this world. And so to scoff at justice is to scoff at God. Proverbs 29:8 talks about these scoffers and the effect that they have. Scoffers set a city aflame, but the wise turn away wrath. Scoffers set a city aflame. And again, I don't think we have to look far to see that we are in a time in which there is an abundance of scoffing, an abundance of skepticism and cynicism about things that ought to be held sacred. And while our city is not literally on fire, I think we all know that the fabric of society is coming apart. And it is coming apart by scoffers. And this sobers me because it says here that the wise turn away wrath. In other words, when wrath is coming forth from the scoffers in a society and they're setting their little fires everywhere, the wise manage to find a way to push it back rather than adding to it. They return the wrath back to its source. They contain it. They bottle it up. They have an antidote to it. And I will simply say this. The wise are supposed to be those that are following and hearing the voice of the God of this world. The rightful God of this world, not the God of this world Paul talks about, just to be clear. And yet we are often known for what we are angry about. And our words have taken on, in all too many cases, an edge that is sharp and harsh towards the world around us. And I have a fear that we may be setting as many fires as we are putting out. And that's a tragedy, because one of the things that Proverbs says over and over and over again is that wise words are life-giving. We've sung about it today. It should not be a mystery to us. One of the distinguishing features of humanity is our capacity for speech, to craft words. It's one of the things that sets us apart from the rest of creation. And so when God describes the creation of the world, it is with words. Let there be light, and there is light. God speaks life into existence and then uses that as the vehicle for bringing life throughout the rest of the story. Ezekiel 36, Son of man, can these dry bones live? Oh Lord, you know. And God says to the prophet, speak to the bones and they will live. Jesus at the grave of Lazarus, moments after he said the verse that we shared with the children earlier, says, Lazarus, come forth, and Lazarus obeys the word of the one who is the resurrection and the life. On the last day, it will be a loud command that goes forth that raises the dead from the graves. And that is why it is the word that became human and dwelt among us. The word that would make God known. The words of the wise are life-giving. Proverbs 18:21 puts it this way. Death and life are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it will eat its fruits. Both. Death and life are in the power of the tongue. Words carry power. All words. And they carry power for death, and they carry power for life. And that second phrase is a little ambiguous, isn't it? Those who love it will eat its fruits. Whether the fruits are the fruits of death or life. Words are never idle. Words are never just words in God's universe. Proverbs 15:4, a gentle tongue is a tree of life, but perverseness in it breaks the spirit. That is a verse that merits some contemplation. A gentle tongue is a tree of life. That phrase, tree of life, is one that occurs a few times in Proverbs, hearkening back to the garden. A gentle tongue is a tree of life. It's a gentle tongue that brings God's blessing, but perverseness, a twisting of the tongue towards destructive ends, breaks the spirit. How many of us have had our spirits broken by someone's words? We know that that is true, that words can break a person's spirits. Proverbs is nothing if not vivid. And so Proverbs 26 gives us a vivid description of that kind of perverseness, that kind of spirit-breaking power of words. It begins with this, whoever meddles in a quarrel not his own is like one who takes a passing dog by the ears. They didn't have pets in the ancient world. This is a wild animal. You grab hold of its ears, you're going to pay. Meddling in a quarrel that is not your own. Again, occasion, audience. The verse that John read before praying goes on to say that he wants people everywhere to lift holy hands in prayer without quarreling. You should know by now that I'm rather passionate about the notion of revival, of God doing an awakening work in the church through an invasion of God's presence that is so obvious and tangible that we as the people of God cannot help to be radically reformed and shine so brightly that the world around us has to take notice. I believe that such a revival always comes on the heels of concerted, devoted prayer. But that prayer has to come from a united church. It cannot come from a church that is simultaneously quarreling. And I have a hunch that what is happening right now in the heavenly realms is that God sees many believers praying fervently for revival while simultaneously quarreling. And I think God is saying, are you going to figure out at some point that I can't have that both ways? A quarreling church will never be a revived church. And so the proverb goes on to talk about this quarreling, like a madman who throws firebrands, arrows, and death is the man who deceives his neighbor and says, I'm only joking. How often do we see that? People flinging words around willy-nilly and then just saying, oh, it's just words. It was just a joke. Lighten up, snowflake. For lack of wood, the fire goes out, and where there is no whisperer, quarreling ceases. The whisperer keeps the argument going, prods, casts doubt on people's motivations and character. As charcoal to hot embers and wood to fire, so is a quarrelsome man for kindling strife. You know the type. The person who just won't let it go. The person who's always looking to start something up. We euphemistically may call it someone who's stirring the pot. Oh, they're just stirring the pot. Oftentimes that pot doesn't need to be stirred. The words of a whisperer are like delicious morsels. They go down into the inner parts of the body. There's a relish and a delight in being that person. Like the glaze covering an earthen vessel are fervent lips with an evil heart. Glaze on pottery covers over all the cracks and imperfections, makes it seem like what it is not. Whoever hates disguises himself with his lips and harbors deceit in his heart. When he speaks graciously, believe him not, for there are seven abominations in his heart. Though his hatred be covered with deception, his wickedness will be exposed in the assembly. And then these warnings for the quarrelsome person, the whisperer, the one who stokes up conflict and strife. Whoever digs a pit will fall into it, and a stone will come back on the one who starts it rolling. A lying tongue hates its victims, and a flattering mouth works ruin. Lord, have mercy on us. Our words carry great power. So what are we to do with all of this? I am convinced that we underestimate the power of our words, and that's really a tragedy, because as the people of the good news, we are first and foremost people who have something to say. We have been given the words of life, the message of the gospel. And the thing that will most quickly undercut the credibility of that witness is the other ways we use our words. We cannot say, Jesus loves you, where the gospel starts and stops, if the rest of our words suggest that we don't care much for the rest of humanity. It just won't fly. And the world is right to question the credibility of our message if the rest of our words don't match. If the world sees a church that's constantly quarreling with itself, it is right to question whether Jesus really loves us all that much. Our words matter. Our words matter all the time. And I'm afraid that we have been careless. Jesus knew that about us, and so he said this in Matthew 12. Either make the tree good and its fruit good, or make the tree bad and its fruit bad, for the tree is known by its fruit. And oftentimes we ask, what fruit? What do we need to have an understanding of here? I'm so grateful that on this occasion, Jesus told us, "You brood of vipers, how can you speak good when you are evil? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. The good person out of his good treasure brings forth good, and the evil person out of his evil treasure brings forth evil. I tell you, on the day of judgment, people will give account for every careless word they speak. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned." Those are sobering thoughts. For every careless word. It just came tumbling out. I didn't mean it. How often do we claim that? It just slipped out. I shouldn't have said it. I didn't mean it. Can I tell you something? Not just common sense, but Jesus tells us that that's always a lie. "I didn't mean it" is always a lie. The exact opposite is true. "That's what I really meant, and I just wasn't quick enough to stop myself from saying it." "I didn't mean it" is only true when we've been really careful with our speech. But we never say that. We have an incredible responsibility. We have been entrusted with life-giving words. Jesus here says, the good person brings out good, the evil person evil. Jesus's little brother, James, wrote a chapter, I think, reflecting on Proverbs and what Jesus said about the tongue. Jesus had a lot to say about the tongue, being wise. And I've given you a paraphrase in the sermon resource updated for our day and age to help us to think about that a little bit. But one of the things that James says is he says, blessing and cursing cannot come out of the same mouth. Blessing and cursing can't come out of the same mouth. With our mouths, we bless our God and Father, and with it, we curse our fellow humans made in the image of God. This should not be, brothers and sisters. Blessing and cursing, and I would suggest to you that our words can fall into one of those two categories. All of our words are either words of blessing that give life or words of cursing that break spirits and start fires. So I wanted to take a moment as we prepare to sing of what our tongues should be singing about and what our tongues should be bearing witness to consistently. And I want you to think about words you've used or words you've heard in the last 24 hours. I want you to write down a word of blessing that you've used or that you've heard, and I want you to write down a word of cursing that you've used or that you've heard. Wise people hear reproof. Wise people heed correction. I want you to ask the Spirit of God to do a corrective work so that out of the overflow of our hearts would come words of life-giving blessing from God.